From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, mortgage rates are going up and California's housing market appears to be slowing down just a bit. We'll talk about the economic factors that are at play and listen to some competing forecasts about what's happening with housing prices. Also on Air Talk, Film Week comes up in our second hour. We'll hear reviews of all the week's new movies.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is October 8th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific Friday and have a nice weekend in store. Coming up next hour, Film Week, we'll hear about the week's new movies and got some really interesting ones. First Man with Ryan Gosling is Neil Armstrong, the first person to set foot on the moon. And Bad Times at the El Royale with quite a cast, Jeff Bridges, John Hamm, and Chris Hemsworth. Also, The Oath, that's film that our critics and some others are talking quite a bit about. So we have a lot of movies. That's coming up on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. But first, we look at what's happening with the California housing market. Realtors are predicting that the housing market is going to soften next year. With us to talk about the various factors that are in play, including rising interest rates on mortgages, is Oscar Way, senior economist at the California Association of Realtors. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start, first of all, with sales. Does it seem as though there is a slowing to the super hot pace that we've had of the past few years?
Indeed, yes. For the last 4 months or so, and of course, the latest data that we have is only through August, but for the last 4 months since May, we have been seeing some decline on a year-over-year basis. And the decline seems to be a sustainable decline, and we haven't finalized our numbers on September yet, but it looks like it is going to be a decline compared to last year also.
Okay. And what's your theory as to the reasons behind the slowdown?
Now, a lot of different things. I think the interest rate increase is definitely something that people pay attention to, but I think also the uncertainty. Because at the same time when we are seeing some decline in sales, we also are seeing home prices continue to increase. For the last few months, we are seeing some increase in 7 or 8% and actually surpassed its previous peak somewhere around June. So people might be thinking that, okay, well, this is probably the market peaking, and they're a little uncertain about, you know, whether they should jump into the market right now to buy at the peak.
So this, despite the fact we've got low unemployment, salaries are up, we've got these other factors. And where do cash buyers factor into this? Because obviously mortgage rates aren't going to be of concern for them. What percentage of the market is cash?
Now, cash buyers is about 20% or so, give or take. I can't remember the exact number. But we do have, you know, a higher percentage of cash buyers as compared to, let's say, 10 years ago or in 2006, 2005. But it's a little bit higher than before. But still, you know, cash buyers, even though they're not affected by increase in interest rates, but they are concerned about, you know, whether they are buying at the peak also. Obviously, no one wants to buy at the peak and then start seeing home prices decline. So people are uncertain because of a lot of different uncertainty, not just the housing market, but also the economic uncertainty about, you know, what direction the economy is going. We know that it will probably sustain its economic growth for the rest of the year. Next year maybe a little bit slower, but still people are a little concerned about both economic and housing market uncertainty.
But you're still predicting that housing prices will climb even though it's slower?
Now, for the year, for this year, 2018, we have already seen some increase in prices, but we are seeing some slow, still price appreciation for the rest of the year, but a slower appreciation. In fact, you know, last month we saw only a 5%, and I said, quote unquote, only because previous year, in earlier part of the year, we saw 7 or 8%. but I believe for the rest of the year it's going to slow down. So this year, because of what we have already seen in terms of price appreciation, we predict we have a prediction of 7%. But next year, it's going to cut into half. We're only seeing a 3% increase in price next year.
But an increase nonetheless. Oscar Way with us, senior economist, California Association of Realtors, also with us, founding partner of Beacon Economics, Chris Thornburg. Chris, welcome back. What do you think is going on right now with the housing market?
Well, I have to agree with Oscar that interest rates are certainly playing a huge role in the slowdown we're seeing out there. You know, last week, mortgage rates got very close to 5%. Now, mind you, relative to, say, the last 30 years, interest rates, mortgage rates are still really low. But, of course, relative to a couple of years ago, they are higher. And it is making those monthly payments, particularly here in high-priced California, that much harder for certain households to achieve. So with that in mind, I think this is a perfectly understandable reaction. It's worth noting, you know, Oscar was talking about California, but these trends we're talking about are really being seen in the U.S. overall. Take, for example, inventories have started to climb just a little bit. They're still very close to historic levels, historically low levels, but they are starting to move up again. Again, perfectly understandable given the interest rate environment.
I'm oversimplifying, you know, what you've said when you've been on us previously, but the takeaway I always come away with is this is supply-demand. I mean, you always hit this point that we just simply don't have enough housing, and that's going to be the prominent factor when it comes to values and to availability. And you see anything changing in that?
No, not really. The state has gotten a few things through. They're upgrading their RENA standards. We have SB 35, which allows developers who have a certain share of affordable housing units to bypass local control. But while they are sort of nibbling around the edges of the problem, you know, we did an analysis not too long ago and asked a question. If you wanted to maintain a 2% job growth in the state of California, how many building permits should you see per year? And the answer is somewhere between 210 and 260,000, somewhere in that range. Right now, the state's running about 125,000, half that pace. So it gets back to the idea that these supply constraints are really starting to bite. And while there is a little bit of slack in the system, for the most part, until California starts to substantially free the private sector to build housing, the reality is these housing shortages are going to maintain those very high prices.
Seems to me like that the previous generations of Californians would often cash out with their home when they retired, would move elsewhere where the cost of living is lower and take their gains in the real estate market. Is that still happening to the same extent? Or in this generation, is there kind of a cultural shift and more people are staying put?
Well, you know, that's a great point. And remember, the boomers are retiring en masse, and they are not only the largest generation of retirees ever, but they are also the healthiest generation and, believe it or not, the wealthiest generation of retirees ever. One of the results of that is they are, for the most part, staying put. And that, I mean, it's funny. I was just talking about this yesterday with some folks, and it's exactly what you're saying. The housing crisis, as bad as it is right now, is going to be exacerbated by this huge wave of retiring boomers who are very likely to sit still in their existing housing, making the labor supply crunch even that much more acute over the next 5 years.
Chris Thornburg, Beacon Economics founding partner with us. If you have questions for our trio of guests as we talk about California's real estate market, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, professor of finance and Arden Realty Chair at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. He also directs the UCLA's Iman Center for Real Estate, Stuart Gabriel. Stuart, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good morning. So you've had a chance to hear from our other two guests. Your thoughts on what we're seeing, perhaps looking forward to the next year with housing prices and what the inventory you think will look like?
Well, Larry, as your other guests have indicated, it's a bit of a mixed picture. And with respect to some of the slowing that we're seeing, that slowing is more evidenced at the upper end of the market. We still, as has been discussed previously, have a very, very difficult affordability problem in the state. and that continues to be manifest in very significant excess demand for any product that's affordable. So we see homes selling and selling well, and even a bit of appreciation at that most affordable range, whereas the upper ranges have slowed down. They've slowed down for reasons that I think are evident. The higher interest rate environment, certainly that affects the entirety of the range. There's more of an investment demand for housing at the upper end of the range, and there's a concern that house prices will continue to slow as interest rates continue to move up. There are also macroeconomic forecasts out there that suggest that while the economy is growing at a elevated above trend rate currently, that as we move out into the next year, into 2019 and into 2020, we're going to see some additional and potentially sharp slowdown in the economy as we move back down from maybe the current 4% rate of growth to something down to 3 to 2, even perhaps less than 2 as we get out into 2020 or whatever. And additionally, as your other guests have indicated, Larry, there and as evidenced in global equity markets, just in the last couple of days, there is just a terrific amount of uncertainty with respect to the composition of macro policy, with respect to potential trade strife with China, with a $1 trillion U.S. budgetary deficit, a $1 trillion U.S. trade deficit. There's a lot of mixed metaphors out there, and all of it creates some of the reduction in investment demand for housing, as well as high levels of uncertainty.
We're talking with Professor Stuart Gabriel, UCLA's Anderson School of Management. He directs UCLA's Ziman Center for Real Estate. JSK writes on the page, the SALT deduction limitations affect higher earners and more expensive homes. Chris Thornburg, your thoughts on the limits on deductibility of property taxes and state taxes, how that might affect people's decisions on buying?
Well, what's interesting about that comment is we got to also remember that there were cuts in the income tax, say at the higher levels of national federal income taxes. And of course, those with pass-through corporations got a nice tax cut as well. Candidly, here in high-priced California, for those high-income earners we're talking about, yeah, they lost it over here, but they probably gained some of it back over there. On net, they're not going to be that influenced. And, you know, candidly, it's worth noting that particularly in a place like California that is so supply constrained, you really don't see that much of an impact of these sort of changes in the financing. A lot of folks have been talking about a big pullback in real estate at the start of the year because of these tax changes. That never occurred. We didn't really see any market effect. It wasn't until these interest rates started to tip up that things really started to slow down. So I don't see that being a big factor.
We still have developable land that is on the periphery of major cities in California, but it seems like the demand for those suburban properties isn't what it was, or that the barriers to building there are too great. What's your assessment of what we're seeing in the way of shifts of what people want in their housing, how far they're willing to drive, where jobs are being created? How is that factoring into all of this issue of construction?
I'm not sure if you're aiming that at me.
Yeah, Chris, I'm sorry.
Weigh in on that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm out at the UC Riverside now. I run a Center for Economic Forecasting and Development out there, along with wearing my Beacon hat. And, you know, actually, the Inland Empire right now is the fastest growing large economy in the state, and from a year-over-year job growth perspective. And the housing market out there actually has been doing spectacular. You'll see a lot of new purchases coming in. Yes, they're being influenced at some level by these interest rates, the way that L.A. is. But candidly, some of the upward mobility of these more inland housing markets is very strong right now, and reflects the fact that a lot of folks who are priced out of the coast are moving inland. You'll see that in Sacramento as well, where again prices are growing at a very solid base right now.
So you think we are creating units? It's just the difficulties coming up with enough units in urban areas, and you know, maybe Stuart Gabriel, you can speak to this point of, you know,
what are the obstacles to, more housing development in some of the areas where, there's opportunity, vacant lots or, rundown homes that could where you could do multifamily housing?
Well, the constraints to development in any of our coastal areas are profound. Most of these areas are built out. They're heavily regulated. They've been regulated for some time. And land costs are so high, Larry, that it's very, very difficult from a private developer profit maximizing perspective to put any affordable product in an area where land costs are as high as they are. So that we have what appear to be almost symbolic efforts at affordable housing development in these coastal areas. But truthfully, it is, as Chris has indicated, if you're looking for material increments to affordable housing supply, those increments are going to occur where land costs are lower, and land costs are lower in interior areas of the state. And the interior areas of the state have always been sort of a spillover area for high housing demand on the coast. So everything on the Interstate 80 corridor going towards Sacramento from the Bay Area, everything going east from L.A. or northeast or southeast or whatever. And this is where, as Chris is indicating, you have home builders like KB Home that are on fire with respect to the amount of product they're creating and selling, noting that this is a product that's desired at an appropriate price point. So, Larry, I guess what I'm saying is we talk a lot about the creation of density in the interior areas, and I think we're all for that. There's been a lot of new density created. One of the problems with that density is that much of it is not affordable. It's at the higher end of the multifamily range. And that, again, is dictated by simple economics, the economics of the very high land costs in these areas.
I want to thank you all for being with us. That's Stuart Gabriel, professor of finance, UCLA, Oscar Way, senior economist, California Association of Realtors, and Chris Thornburg, Beacon Economics founding partner. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about a new study that was just published in the journal Science, which looks at genetic profiles that are publicly available and tries to determine how easy it is to identify an individual from just a bit of their DNA. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, we're going to debate Proposition 10, which does away with the Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which limits the ability of local cities and counties to enact more thoroughgoing rent control. We'll hear the pros and cons of that coming up, and of course, Film Week at 11 here on 89.3 KPECC. Well, you're probably familiar with last April, the investigation by Sacramento authorities in which they arrested Joseph DeAngelo as the suspect in the many Golden State killings, as they were called. One of the big breaks in the case came from a public genealogical website. They got a DNA sample and were able to match that. The question is, beyond law enforcement, could a member of the public, could a governmental entity not in law enforcement, find an individual, track a person down from a piece of genetic information? And this new study published yesterday in the journal Science says, yeah, with some pretty basic information about someone and some DNA, that for those of European heritage, yeah, you could most likely track it down. With us to talk about the study and what the implications are for privacy is New York Times science reporter Heather Murphy. Heather, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So share with us, please, Jani Verlich at Columbia University, computer science researcher. Did he look at the Golden State Killer investigation, get the idea to do this from that case?
I think it definitely contributed. So people who work in this world have been aware for quite some time, maybe this is possible, because for a long time, even before we're seeing all these criminal investigations using this technique, it's been used in other ways. For example, adoptees who are trying to track down their biological parents, they don't know a lot about them. They're using these genealogical research databases to try and figure out people's identity in ways that are pretty unprecedented. And so when the Golden State Killer case announced an arrest in April, they thought, okay, maybe it's time to study this. And then pretty quickly, there were a bunch of other arrests using a similar technique, all using cousins' DNA on these public genealogical databases. So that is what sparked it. And they thought, let's study this. Are they just getting lucky? Or how easy is it to identify someone this way?
Well, and I think a lot of folks took solace, were concerned about privacy, and saying, well, you know, this isn't from Ancestry.com, 23andMe. These are public genealogical sites where people are choosing to put their information. If I choose not to do that, I'm not going to be linked and identified. But this study sort of debunks that idea.
Exactly. There really is no such thing as genetic privacy in the way we traditionally think about privacy, because we're all related to a lot of people. So essentially, we all have about 850 people out there somewhere in the world who falls into a third cousin range. And we've never met those people, but they're somewhere. And so all it essentially takes is for one of those people to decide to get into family history and maybe upload their genetic profile to a database that can be used by investigators. And then it's not a sure thing. This is one thing it's important to reinforce is it's at this point, this is really difficult work. Like, there's maybe a few dozen people in the world right now who are really good at figuring out people's identity through their third cousins. But it's possible.
And if you've got the information, as Professor Ehrlich did here, if you've got some information about the person, they actually used someone that they did know the identity of in this study, but pretended that they didn't for the purpose of running the test. And they were able to identify this Utah woman, even though her information was not up on a public genealogical website. So what are the potential ways that these websites could limit who would have access to genetic information?
Yeah, so that is a good question, and that is something that a lot of people are interested in talking about right now. It's important to note that it's the way that it's possible to figure out who somebody is through their cousin's DNA. The reason it's possible at this moment in time is because we also have so much other information about us out there on the internet. So when you're starting to try and figure out, you start with that initial genetic clue and then you fill it in. So they all sort of build on each other and make it possible to identify someone. One proposal that Dr. Ehrlich suggested involves this sort of special signature, sort of the way our passport has this signature that makes it hard for somebody else to use our passport, sort of embedding something like that in the genetic profiles that these labs are creating. Whether that would actually work, whether everyone wants to see that happen, is something that people will have to continue to discuss. I think what some people are also saying is that this is just inevitable. Like, our DNA does not belong to us alone. It belongs to our family members as well. So another way that some people would like to see these practices limited is just coming up with some ways to create some guidelines for when law enforcement, for example, could use these sites in that way. You know, are we okay with sexual assaults and murders? I mean, there's been a lot of success with that recently, but are we okay with DNA being identified for law enforcement by a petty crime or somebody who's charged with something that involves political activity? So these are sort of some of the things that people are talking about right now.
Heather Murphy, thank you very much for talking with us about this new study done out of Columbia University, published in the journal Science. We appreciate it.
Sure. Sure, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Science reporter for the New York Times, Heather Murphy, who's been studying this area of science for some time. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. In 1 minute, it's a debate for the rest of today's Air Talk focused on Proposition 10, the rent control prop. We'll be back in a minute. A number of California's major cities have rent control ordinances currently on the books. The idea, of course, is to help people who are longtime residents in rental properties be able to afford to stay in those properties, even as the value of those multi-unit structures go up. The limits on rent control in California are largely through what's known as the Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, and it limits rent control for the cities that choose to enact those policies in three major ways. Only applies to single-family homes, and the rent control cannot apply to construction that was finished after February 1st of 1995, so properties built in the last 23 years are not subject to rent control. And third, rent control does not apply when a new renter comes into the property. So once it turns over, if a rent-controlled unit opens up, the tenant leaves, new tenant comes in, the owner of the property can set it at market rate. So that's current under the Costa-Hawkins. But Proposition 10 on your November 6th California ballot would do away with Costa-Hawkins and would enable those cities that choose to enact rent control to have much more latitude in the choices that they make once they were free from Costa-Hawkins. With us to talk about Prop 10, we begin with Occidental College Professor of Politics and Urban and Environmental Policy and Representative for Yes on 10, Peter Dreyer. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry.
So give us what you see as the practical benefit of 10 if it's passed.
Proposition 10 is about local control. It's giving cities in California the option to decide whether they want to regulate rents to help address the affordability crisis in California. Rents have gone up twice as fast as people's incomes, and so most Californians are renting paying 50% or 35% or 40% of their income just to keep a roof over their head. So what Prop 10 would allow cities to do is to adopt a stronger set of rent regulations. It would apply to apartment buildings that were built after 1978, but it would not apply to any new construction. And as a result of that, it won't really hurt the ability of developers to build new apartments. The no people are saying that it'll hurt the supply of housing, but that's not the case.
So it doesn't apply to new construction?
What
is the date then at which what's considered new?
With the date that the passage of the ordinance, of the proposition. And so there's rent control laws all over the country, and none of them apply to new construction. What it would do is it'll allow some of the apartments that were built after 1978 to have rent regulations, and it would allow landlords a fair return on their – by the state constitution, they have to have a fair return on their investment. And so the cities will be able to regulate rents. They'll be able to stop rent gouging, but they won't have an impact on landlords' ability to stay in business.
Well, and we'll talk later about what fair return and how that's determined. Yeah. Does this apply as well to counties for their unincorporated areas? Could LA County for Altadena, for example,
yes,
implement this? So
yeah,
not just cities, but
yes.
All right. We're talking with Peter Dreyer, Occidental College professor, proponent of Proposition 10, the rent control measure. Right after our news update, we'll talk with Deborah Carlton. She is the Senior VP of Governmental Affairs for the California Apartment Association and is officially with the No on 10 campaign. We'll talk with her coming up. But first, time for a live update from Megan McCarty-Carino. Coming up, 11 o'clock, Film Week with our critics. We're going to hear what they think of First Man. Ryan Gosling plays astronaut Neil Armstrong. Damien Chazelle, who directed La La Land, This no musical. Neil doesn't sing and dance. We're going to find out what our critics thought of the film. And we'll also talk about Bad Times at the El Royale, a film starring Jeff Bridges, John Hamm, Dakota Johnson, and The Oath, which is a feature directorial debut for Ike Barinholtz. We'll find out what our critics think of that action comedy. Those just a few of the movies on Film Week, just about 20 minutes away here on KPCC. Right now, our focus is on Proposition 10, the rent control measure on your November 6th California ballot. It's one of the entirety of the ballot measures that on our voter cram session we're going to be going through in an hour. So next week on Thursday, make sure in the 11 o'clock hour you have your sample ballot with you. If you can safely do that, if you're driving, I don't advise. But go through all of the ballot measures. You'll hear the pros and cons from our expert panel. Right now, as we debate Proposition 10, with us in opposition to the prop, Deborah Carlton, California Apartment Association Senior VP. Thank you so much for being with us, Ms. Carlton.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
So what do you see as the concerns about how you think the housing market would be affected by passage of 10?
Well, you know, certainly Prop 10 doesn't follow along your typical party lines, right? So we have both candidates for governor, Newsom and Cox, are opposed to Prop 10 as well because they know that it will affect housing. It will allow local governments to put in what we call stringent forms of rent control. Right now, Costa-Hawkins is rent control, but it's a more moderate form of rent control. It will allow local governments to put rent control on single-family homes. And it will allow them to put it on new construction, despite the Yes on campaign's statement that it will not affect new construction. It can affect new construction. In fact, a lot of the local measures that are being proposed right now are rallying up and preparing for passage of Prop 10 by creating ordinances that would apply to new construction and single-family homes. So the downside, obviously, to that is interference with construction. Even your state legislative analyst's office has said that it would harm new construction. That's the independent analyst's office. And, of course, we saw in the 80s and 70s and 80s that Berkeley, Santa Monica lost thousands of rental properties because single-family homeowners got out of the market. So single-family property owners who find themselves under rent control would sell their homes or convert them back to owner-occupied housing.
Now, would that not be beneficial in a sense that, you know, we're in such a tight housing market, not just rentals, but sales, that those homes wouldn't be rented out, that people could purchase them? So there would be an upside to that.
Well, sure. I guess it depends on who you ask, but I think the Prop 10 side wants to make sure that tenants remain in place. And unfortunately, in this situation, they would lose their homes. And that's not, I think, what we're hoping for, what this Prop 10 is all about.
All right. Also, on the issue of fair return, how do you see that being defined or left undefined by the proposition?
The proposition doesn't define it. In fact, the courts have never defined it. So it's left up to unelected local boards to make that decision. So, for example, your mortgage is not included in what is the fair rate of return. And so it's really left up to boards where you have to go ask for a rent increase if you have a repair to make or if you have a roof you have to repair. Oftentimes, they're rejected or not approved.
What kind of boards? You said they're unelected boards. What kind of boards are they typically that decide that?
So it's your local rent boards under this. In most cities now, you have local rent boards. They're either elected or appointed. And they make the decisions about your fair rate of return.
All right. Peter Dreyer, proponent of Proposition 10. On that issue of, you said that it does not apply to new construction distinctly, so we have a difference of opinion here.
Yeah, there's no city in America that has rent control that new construction is included. And so
but
that's
theoretically,
just,
it could be here.
No, it can't. And there's also, Deborah, you know that no city has ever imposed rent control on single-family homes, owner-occupied single-family homes.
Berkeley did it.
It'll have absolutely no impact on single-family homeowners. This isn't about single-family homeowners. What it would apply to are some of the large corporate landlords that over the last 5 years have been gobbling up a lot of foreclosed homes and renting them out at exorbitant prices. And I think that, you know, the voters of California need to understand who's behind this No on 10 campaign. The biggest contributor is Blackstone, this private equity firm, a Wall Street firm, that's put in over $2 million into their campaign because they're the ones that are most responsible for gobbling up. They're the biggest landlord in California right now. Well, they've been gobbling up single-family homes.
That is not true.
And Sam Zell and Jeff Palmer, the big landlord in Los Angeles.
So property owners, so they went in, but you dispute that?
Big corporate landlords.
Right, right. Blackstone is less than 1% of the market. That's just such a misnomer. So to say that it's scary Wall Street, that's just not the fact. In fact, most cities, your mom and pop landlords, those who own less than five units, make up 30 to 40% of the market. So if they're allowed to get out or they will get out, that's a huge problem for California.
Peter, I wanted to ask you about the property tax potential hit here, because wouldn't this, as if values decline because of rent control, wouldn't that potentially have a negative effect then on reappraisals for property taxes?
Well, not under Prop 13. And also the reality is that landlords are allowed to raise rents, and they're allowed to raise rents based on the cost of living. And so their profits remain, pretty significant. And so and it'll have no effect on single family home property values. There's absolutely no evidence of that happening. So
because there are not enough single family home rentals to have an effect. Or?
Yeah. I mean, what the opponents often say is that rent control will hurt property values for homeowners. But that's just not true. But there are a lot of single family homes that are being rented by, as I said, these big corporate absentee landlords. And, Deborah can say whatever she wants about the mom-and-pop landlords, but the people that are paying for her campaign, the people that are raising $100 million to put out the propaganda to persuade voters to vote no, are the big corporate landlords who have a big stake in this, and the private equity firms. And so that's who's behind it. This is about protecting renters from being displaced. This is about protecting long-term affordable housing. We need to build more housing. It won't have any impact on that. So we need to do two things. We need to build more housing to solve the housing crisis, and we need to protect the existing stock of affordable rental housing. And that's what this Proposition 10 would do.
You're saying that it's these big companies behind it. So are you saying that the people that own like one home they rent out or have one or two apartment buildings, they're not behind? They're not opposed to this? Is that what you're saying?
They're not the ones funding this campaign. The people that the
issue isn't just who funds it, right? It's who's in favor of it, who's against it. So,
well, I'm sure that there are some landlords that I know that are in favor of it. They're responsible landlords. They know that they get a rent increase every year under rent control. They won't be able to kick people out illegally like they're doing right now in Los Angeles and other cities because of vacancy decontrol. That means that if they know they can raise rents if the people leave, if tenants leave, they're going to find ways to kick them out. That's
because you can kick it up for the new tenants.
A lot of seniors,
and under this, you could keep the rent.
So this keeps rents stable. It stabilizes neighborhoods. It allows landlords to have annual rent increases, but it doesn't allow them to rent gouge. So you'll remember on—
All right. Deborah Carlton to come back in the conversation. Your response.
So there's a lot of things that Peter just said. So first of all, 80% of our campaign donors are small mom and pop. So let's make that very clear right now. Under current moderate forms of rent control, you can't just kick your tenants out because we have what's called just cause eviction. It has to be based upon a very specific cause. So you can't kick out tenants just to raise the rent.
That's not what's going on.
Yeah, but that is— If it's going on, then local cities are not imposing the laws they should impose because that's what it is allowed under the state law. So that's just not part of what Prop 10 is all about. Prop 10 is about making sure that you don't just protect those in place. It's about imposing rent control on more housing. Single-family homes is a big part of that.
But what about Peter's point that there's a distinct benefit in rent control being continued for a unit if it's under rent control when there's a churn in the tenant, and that as opposed to incentivizing owners to, however they do it, move people out for someone to come in at a much higher rent, that morally there's an argument for keeping that as a rent-controlled unit?
Sure. We certainly agree that stabilizing your communities is a positive thing. So, again, that's why just cause is in place, so you can't kick the tenant out. You cannot raise the rent under your current rent control laws to move somebody out. So What the other issue, I think, here is to make sure that we understand that Prop 10 is not just about stabilizing your neighborhoods. It's about going after the small mom and pops.
We'll continue our conversation with Deborah Carlton of the California Apartment Association, where she's senior VP. She's in opposition to Proposition 10 on your California ballot. Peter Dreyer, Occidental College professor, proponent of Proposition 10, which would do away with the Costa-Hawkins limitations on rent control that could be passed by cities and counties for unincorporated areas. You can share your questions for our guests on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, or call 866-893-5722. Our call screeners will pass on your questions to me. Back in 1 minute. Let me share some listener comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also, if you have questions, you can put them on the page. Lee writes, as a property manager dealing with owners that are all exclusively very small mom and pop, mostly single family homes with maybe a few apartments, I can say most of them are going to want to get out of the market. And the single family homes would be sold, would come out of the rental market entirely. That's Lee sharing her thoughts about this. Once again, we're 866-893-KPECC. JSK writes, there'll be a shortage of units available for those seeking one, and landlords are going to be very selective with no vacancy decontrol. Grace in Culver City wonders, how would this affect me? I live in a property in Culver City, which, of course, is seeing its values going up tremendously. My unit has been going up 10% every year for the past 3 years. I've got a 1940s-era building like many in Culver City. Peter Dreyer, proponent of Prop 10, how would this have any effect on our listener, Grace?
If she's living in an apartment building that was built in 1940s, and there's no rent control in Culver City right now. And if the city council of Culver City decides to have rent control, that means that her landlord will be able to raise the rents every year, but not 10% a year, not gouge her. And the tenants that come after her, after she decides to move, would be covered by rent control as well. So, and this is exactly the kind of tenant that needs protection, the people who were getting 10, 15, 20% rent increases every year because there's a shortage of housing. And so they landlords are able to take advantage of that. This is about protecting people.
We should mention, though, that in her case, Culver City could enact, even with Costa-Hawkins, rent control that would affect her unit now. That's just a decision of Culver City's council.
That's true.
Yeah. All right. Again, your questions on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, or 866-893-KPECC. John in Fullerton says, a proponent keeps saying it won't affect new housing construction, but think of all the people that were told that when Costa-Hawkins first passed. As legislation evolves, it keeps capturing newer and newer units. Peter Dreyer?
Well, that's not true, actually, that the Costa-Hawkins law puts a limit on new construction in terms of when you can impose rent control. And so there's no evidence whatsoever that Costa-Hawkins has made things any better. In fact, you know, that Costa-Hawkins was passed in 1995. The landlord lobby said that it'll free up the housing market and make things better. The housing market has gotten much, much worse since Costa-Hawkins was adopted. And so if we get rid of Costa-Hawkins, if we repeal it, we pass Prop 10, then more tenants will be protected from being evicted. It'll protect the housing stock. And there will be a huge increase in new construction as well, because it won't affect new construction. Landlords.
Hold on. But the question is it worse because of Costa-Hawkins or just because of supply and demand? There aren't enough units for
The big problem
rent.
Is zoning.
Right. Costa-Hawkins didn't create our housing crisis. Local cities have done a horrible job of making sure that we have enough housing. They haven't balanced their jobs with their housing. The NIMBYs are getting in the way of helping us construct new housing. We saw that at the legislature this year, interfering with new construction along transit corridors. So Costa-Hawkins is not the cause.
All right. On the ability of these rent control boards to be able to set what's a fair return, why not have that in cases where we've seen a tremendous rise, the increase of the value of properties that landlords have? Rents have gone up tremendously, and even for mom-and-pop people, they're making money typically in a way that they haven't in the past, and that does put the squeeze on renters. So why not have a limit on the profitability of that so that you balance the two interests?
Yeah, if Prop 10 had done something much more moderate, we might not be sitting here in this station. But Prop 10 didn't do that. Prop 10 is just opening the floodgates to allow local governments to do whatever they want. Unfortunately, during the 90s, when the legislature passed Costa-Hawkins, they realized that local governments were not doing a good service to not only owners, but to tenants at the local level. Berkeley had imposed it on single-family homes. Berkeley had lost 3,000 rental units. Santa Monica lost 9,000 rental units. We were seeing gentrification. So they said, let's put the brakes on these stringent forms of rent control. Let's do something more moderate. That's not what Prop 10 does. Prop 10 is not moderate. That's why it's opposed by the building trades and the NAACP and the veterans. They say this is not a moderate form of rent control.
So I want to ask both of you, what's your vision? If Prop 10 were to be passed, what effect would it have on the housing supply?
Well, there are certain cities that are in place right now with rent control that are gearing up and already have their ordinances in place to apply to single-family homes. So Berkeley, Oakland, Richmond, San Francisco, and Santa Monica, the light switch would be turned on there, would immediately apply and could apply to single-family homes. We also have some that have qualified for the ballot. National City, Sacramento.
I'm talking about the supply.
That has everything to do with supply, because we believe we'll go back to the 70s and 80s where we lost housing. So the supply there would be reduced. Berkeley also put a stoppage on new construction back then, too. So we believe the supply also will be affected in that way.
Peter Dreyer, what effect do you think Prop 10 would have on the housing supply?
So the three largest cities in California with rent control, in the Bay Area, San Francisco, San Jose, and Oakland, have had huge increases in supply, even though there's rent control, because it's not covered by new construction is not covered by rent control. So it'll have no major impact on reducing supply, and it will protect the people that are already living in their apartments, and those apartments will remain affordable for the long term. And, you know, and Deborah knows, I mean, she knows that no city is going to impose rent control on single-family homes that are not owned by big corporate absentee landlords. That's the target of the single-family rental market, which are these big Wall Street and other corporate absentee landlords that are making huge, huge profits by gobbling up these single-family homes.
We talk about this subject. I get all kinds of listeners who own apartment buildings who are not huge companies. So they're in it, too. Miriam in West Hollywood says, I own a triplex. Oh, West Hollywood is under rent control. If Prop 10 passes, what would be the increase caps for new tenants? Right now, I can raise it to market value. Would that be all the rent board's determination?
The rent board could determine what would happen upon turnover. So currently today, as you pointed out, it's when the tenant moves out, the landlord can then raise it to whatever the market will bear. However, it then comes back under rent control.
All right. I want to thank you both so much. Deborah Carlton of the California Apartment Association, No on 10 side. Peter Dreyer, Occidental College professor, and the Yes on 10. November 6th, your California ballot. You can decide.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by October 8th to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast miniseries Halloween Unmasked, 8 parts looking at the film Halloween, which was filmed right here in Southern California. Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Synagogues.com. We begin
with First Man, highly anticipated biographical drama from Oscar-winning director Damien Chazelle. He teams up once again with Ryan Gosling, like they did in La La Land. But this time, Gosling is Neil Armstrong, alongside Claire Foy, who plays Armstrong's wife, Janet, film based on the true story of the 1969 mission to the moon that led Armstrong to be the first man to walk on the lunar surface.
Neil, if it does turn out, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that when the thought hits you? Gosh, suppose that flight successful?
We're planning on that flight being successful.
First Man, written by Josh Singer, based on James R. Hansen's book. Tim, what'd you think of First Man?
And perhaps constrained a little bit by that book. Close-ups is the first thing that I think of. When folks go see this movie, the thing that they're going to notice is the way that it is actually composed, which is almost in a series of extreme close-ups. Some of them are very effective. Gosling's eyes through the helmet, dials and switches and things like that. Even when the film widens a bit, we mostly only widen to sort of loose medium shots. Very seldom is there a shot in this film that is a head-to-toe human being. It's intentional. It's meant to create a sense of claustrophobia and perspective and point of view. Here's the thing about this film. As much as I wanted to like it, it feels like a film that might have been made by Steven Spielberg or Scorsese or Coppola, any of the cast, any of the grand, wonderful filmmakers of my generation, say. But it doesn't feel like a Damien Chazelle film. And it may not be fair to say that there ought to be something called a Damien Chazelle. He's only made four. But I thought that there was, and I thought that I could identify them. But I swear to you, you could swap him out for almost any of those directors, and this film feels like that, which isn't a bad thing. It just wasn't expected, and I'm disappointed.
What'd you think, Amy?
I'm not quite sure it's up to the level of Spielberg. Yeah, I feel like Damien Chazelle is going for this Wizard of Oz thing, where it's so close, so grainy, where you're studying Ryan Gosling's pores like they're the surface of the moon, just so at the end, when he lands on the moon, he can pull back for that, ta-da, here is Oz, here is the moon shot, which is gorgeous, and it feels like you're exhaling for the first time, and it's also 2 hours into the movie. So I wasn't the biggest fan of this. On an emotional level, I love a story about when Americans put science first, about when we dared to dream really big. But that's just the facts and the beats of the case. The movie itself, I was pretty underwhelmed by. Although if people have recently seen Free Solo, the documentary that came out a couple weeks ago about the freehand mountain climber who climbed El Capitan, there are scenes in here where you realize, oh, Ryan Gosling, if you put his character, if you put his Neil Armstrong in an MRA, he has the same lack of fear. And the two men feel incredibly parallel. So that's interesting, but the movie doesn't really go far with it.
And of course, this film is about Armstrong. It's a biopic about him. It's not really about the space race at all. The space race just sort of encapsulates the context of it all. So we spend a lot of time with him and his family. As much as I am a fan, or really a horrible dilettante, really of the space race, I did not know that he had a daughter, who had passed away in 1961. The year that I was born. And so by 1969, when all of this is happening, I'm 8 years old, I'm looking at the moon. And all of this happened in a span of only 60 years from when the Wright brothers first took flight. It's all of that is quite amazing. As a biopic, though, that's where I think it might fail the most. As a biopic, I still don't know anything about Neil Armstrong, and I met him twice.
Wow.
Oh, wow. I was torn with that same plot point because I didn't know that about him either. And yet I think at this level of watching biopics and biopics and biopics, I feel so immune to the dead daughter thing where the daughter's showing up in flashbacks constantly where everything is revolved through her. And then also having the wife at home just being sad and nervous. It's a shame, I guess, that so many of our biopics do follow the same beats of a man's life. So you're right. I wish there was more Neil Armstrong there.
We're talking about First Man, a biographical picture about Neil Armstrong. Ryan Gosling stars, Damien Chazelle directed. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. Damien Chazelle was on the frame with John Horn recently. And if you want to hear that interview, just visit our Film Week page. We have a link to kpcc.org/theframe. And coming up later on the program, rocket scientist Anita Sengupta, who was with us earlier in the week, and she happened to mention to me off air that she
she thought First Man was the best film on space that she had seen, that most got it right. We're going to find out why she thought that coming up. A true rocket scientist, formerly of JPL, and now with Virgin Hyperloop One. We'll hear what she has to say later on. Next up, it's the mystery thriller Bad Times at the El Royale. Stars an ensemble cast headed by Jeff Bridges, John Hamm, Dakota Johnson, and Chris Hemsworth. A movie centers around seven strangers, each with a secret, who meet at Lake Tahoe's El Royale, a rundown hotel with a dark past.
This is not a place for a priest, Father. You shouldn't be here.
We might need to work on your sales pitch, son. The El Royale, no place for a priest.
There are other hotels, Father. Maybe closer to Tahoe, I could help you find one. I'm sure you would be happier there.
Miles, is it? If this is not a place for a priest, Miles, then this is exactly where the Lord wants me.
Bad Times at the El Royale. I couldn't tell whether this movie was going to be tongue-in-cheek or not, Amy.
It is so fun. I enjoyed the devil out of this movie. I saw it last night at a theater with a crowd, and I thought it was so enjoyable. It's written and directed by Drew Goddard, who people may know for The Cabin in the Woods. Like, he takes genre pictures, in that case like a horror slasher film, and he finds all the wrinkles in it and makes fun of them, makes fun of the pattern. Here, this is, you know, we've seen a lot of strangers and mysterious things and people with guns movies, but he does this one so intelligently and so cleverly. The El Royale is a motel set in right on the border between California and Nevada, with a red line dividing it in half. Half the motel looks one way. California rooms are a dollar more expensive.
It's funny. And like the real Cal Neva Lodge, which is right on the swimming pool, has a line go right through the middle of it.
Well, yes. I'm booking a trip because it looked amazing. And he does in here kind of shape-shifting with all of the characters. You show up thinking they're one way. Everybody reverses. And I can't say that the movie is incredibly emotionally deep, but you can say that he tries. He tries to give emotional beats, especially when you have this character who's a singer played by Cynthia Erivo, who people might know. She was part of the 2015 Color of Purple revival, in which she won an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony. So she only needs one more to get her EGOT immediately before we all find out who she is. She's awesome in this.
Yeah. This movie, yes, Drew Goddard, Cabin in the Sky, but he's channeling our Quentin Tarantino. He is. This is part Pulp Fiction, part Four Rooms. Set in about 1972, you got Nixon on television talking all the time, and the war in Vietnam, and something that looks like the Manson murders, but isn't the Manson murders, sort of playing out on the television all the time. As we watch what goes on in these rooms and how these characters start to intermingle and cross over, this movie opens so hot, and that might be the problem of it. If it has a problem, is that it opens so hot, it's going to be tough to stick the landing. And it doesn't quite stick the landing, because it almost has to end ordinarily because it opens so hot. Good movie. Don't be too disappointed at the end, because just go along for the ride. Oh, Jeff Bridges, he is just outstanding in this movie.
All right. Bad Times at the El Royale, written and directed by Drew Goddard. It's rated R in wide release. The Oath, a comedy from first-time director Ike Barinholtz, who also stars in the movie with Tiffany Haddish. Carrie Brownstein and Billy Magnuson also star. It's a movie about how one politically divided family's Thanksgiving turns ugly when an argument starts over an oath that Americans are required to sign, pledging loyalty to the government.
This is not the America that I know.
Christopher, we said we're not talking politics.
I'm not going to ruin Thanksgiving, I promise. Rest assured.
You are Nazis!
My favorite thing about liberals, as soon as they're triggered, they call everyone a Nazi.
Oh, shut up, Katie.
No politics.
You treat people who don't agree with everything you say like they're morons.
Wasn't that long ago, if you worked for a California community college, you had to sign one of those lawyers. I had to sign it when I worked at Pasadena City College. The Oath is the film. What'd you think, Amy?
I mean, it gave me the absolute shivers. I don't know if anybody else got any shivers hearing that clip. I don't know if this is the movie people might want to see with their families on Thanksgiving. It depends on how much you get along with them politically. But it is about a moment a lot like now, where there is the slow burn. They have about 7 months heads up to this Thanksgiving, warning all of Americans that they should sign this loyalty oath. Not a big deal. You might get a tax break if you do. Everyone's downplaying it. And Ike Barinholtz, who people know him as a comedian, he was in Blockers a few months ago. He writes and directs this. This is his first film. He's a very stubborn, hard-headed guy who's just not going to do it. And his wife, Tiffany Haddish, says she really agrees with him. And most of the family that he has is in different shades of just sign it, you you liberal freak. I think it builds to a terrific point. The first half of this film I thought was really funny. The second half, it turns into more of a horror film, which I wasn't quite expecting, and I liked it a little bit less. But the first half of this, I was absolutely sold.
Yeah, a dark comedy for sure. Approaching that sort of Very Bad Things level of dark comedy. Not so much Bad Santa dark comedy, which is great.
Yeah.
So we go there. In case it's not obvious, Ike is white and Tiffany is black. And they have an interracial daughter. This oath thing has all kinds of sort of and the thing of it is, you're not required to sign the oath. You probably ought to sign the oath. And he is just so hardcore liberal. I mean, he is not going to sign this oath. All his friends are not going to. And one by one, they fall away. One by one, they fall away. And he is just not going to let it go. I like that about this movie. There are these people roaming around who are some sort of like, I don't know, quasi cops, but not cops. And they look into people to see whether or not they've signed the oath. And two of these guys, one played by John Cho, come to his house. And they want to know whether or not he signed the oath. And he's not having it. And that's when it starts to spiral out of control. It does get ugly. It does get brutal. It does get mean. I think it saves itself right at the end, to my mind.
I agree. And I was really impressed by Tiffany Haddish, by the way. She is very underplayed in this. She's almost showing, I have range, put me in dramas as well, which I was very impressed by.
Yeah, although it's funny. We should say it's funny. It really is funny.
It is funny.
It is funny.
The Oath, the action comedy directed, written by, and starring Ike Barinholtz with Tiffany Haddish and Carrie Brownstein. The film is rated R. It's at selected theaters. Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, based on the books by R.L. Stine. This film version directed by Ari Sindel. What'd you think, Tim?
Well, all right. So you have a completely different cast, different writers, different directors. And Jack Black shows up for about 3 minutes in the whole daggum movie. That first movie was so good because it was all about Jack Black and what was going on. It really had to do with how we use horror. This is just a Halloween movie. So you have this puppet named Slappy, and he's this creepy little puppet, one of those creepy puppets, and he's walking around, and he wants a family. So he latches onto this little family, and they don't really want him, so he gets mad, so he starts to bring all of the Halloween monsters to life. Some of the animation in this is really, really, really good. There are these witches with these green pumpkin heads that are just absolutely frightening, and a giant spider, but you sort of like, you slip into this movie, and you're wondering, what does this have to do with R.L. Stine again? Because there are no R.L. Stine creatures actually in it. And then Jack Black shows up and the movie's over.
All right, that's it in a nutshell. In a Goosebump. Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween. It's rated PG and wide release, starring Jeremy Ray Taylor and Khalil Harris, Ari Sandell, the director, Rob Lieber, the screenwriter adapting or basing it on the books of R.L. Stine. Also want to let you know, tickets just on sale today for our next Film Week screening Sunday afternoon. First time we've done a matinee in the series. Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, just as your holiday season gets underway, chance for you to come see The Artist at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. We'd love to have you there. It's going to be a great opportunity with our Film Week critics. Wade Major, Leo Lowenstein will be with us, and Hollywood historian and consultant on The Artist, Mark Wanamaker, also joining us. That's coming up Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, 1 o'clock. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. And what I'm so excited about is we're going to watch The Artist, 2011 Best Picture Oscar winner, just a couple of blocks south of where the theater scenes were actually filmed for the movie, at the Tower Theater, right there on Broadway in the historic theater district. So it's going to be fun. We'll be there very close to where the movie itself was actually filmed, The Artist. And I'm a huge fan of silent films from the masters, Keaton and Chaplin, Lloyd. And when I first heard about The Artist, that a French director was doing a silent film that was going to be, you know, shot in Hollywood based on this era when movies went from silent to talkies, as a little skeptical until I saw the film and then loved it like so many others, as well as the Academy. The Artist, Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon. You buy your tickets now, you get the best choice of seats. kpecc.org/in-person. We have a lot more reviews coming up, including the drama Sadie and the biographical flick Beautiful Boy, here on Film Week on KPCC.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with Tim Cogshell and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the drama Sadie, starring Sophia Mitry-Schloss, Melanie Linsky, and John Gallagher Jr. It's written and directed by Megan Griffiths. Tim, what'd you think?
Well, this is actually my favorite movie of the week. This is just a wonderful little independent film. With no movie stars or anything like that. Megan has done quite a bit of directing, including Animal Kingdom, the television version of Animal Kingdom. She knocked out a few of those that were really, really good. So this is about this young woman, a teenager, and her little friend, and they live in this trailer park with her mother. Her father is away at one of the wars and has been gone for a really long time. And she's very, very deeply attached to her father, we can tell. But we can also tell that there's something sort of odd going on there. Her mother is a nurse. And this guy, just a guy, a regular guy, moves into the trailer next door and starts up a relationship with her mom. And she's just not having it. And it's about that, this sort of the way she's coming of age and trying to protect her father's spot. And she's just a little soldier, she is, just like her father. But she's going to have to deal with some realities. And this movie just moves along so methodically. The language is just so true and so real. And she is just extraordinary. When you can see her break when her heart breaks. You can just see it in her eyes. That's just a gift.
Do you know if this is the debut of the actress?
I did not. You know, I should have looked that up. I didn't look it up. It's not the debut of Megan, but I can't believe that this would be her first project.
Yeah, Sadie is the film. What'd you think, Amy?
I agree. I really, really, really loved it. I mean, this went high on my list as soon as I saw that Melanie Linsky was involved because she is consistently one of our absolute best actresses. And here she's living this, you know, drama of a woman who's married to a husband who's not writing her letters anymore, who's being pursued a bit by Anthony Hale. He plays Buster on Arrested Development. He's also the principal at her daughter's school. And then also this new man who moves into her trailer park, who has a pill addiction, who she wants to help so much. She has a very big bleeding heart. It's very messy. She's living in this one film. Her daughter's living in this other one where every man who enters their life is a direct threat to her father. And the child is just unable to see this through her mother's eyes at all. And that clash, that daughter's fear that her mom is being selfish, winds up being so dark and so destructive. I was very engaged in this the whole way through.
Yeah. Is it a tough watch?
I wouldn't say it's too tough. I mean, what helps is you have characters like Daniel Brooks, who plays one of her best friends, who plays a local bartender, who's so funny and so amazing and is just such a burst of life. This trailer park feels very populated with personalities, and I think that takes a while.
Real people. What I call a real Ilya Kazan sort of cast. These faces, you know,
the old
black dude who everybody calls grandpa. He's not any of the grandpas, and he sits there and he's literally carving. He's whittling, but it's just great, and so funny, yes, but heavy and about a thing.
All right. And by the way, this is the fifth film, and plus she's done television work, so she, for her age, is an experienced hand. Sophia Mitry-Schloss stars with Melanie Linsky in Sadie, our critics recommending Megan Griffith's film. Griffith's the writer-director. It's unrated. You can see it in Hollywood, at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. Also this week, Beautiful Boy, a drama starring Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet. It's directed by Felix van Groningen. It's co-written with Luke Davies. The film, based on the books Beautiful Boy by David Sheff and Tweak by Nick Sheff, chronicling the experience of survival, relapse, and recovery in a family coping with addiction over the years.
You think that you have this under control.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand how scared you are.
I understand why I do things. It doesn't make me any different, all right?
I'm attracted to craziness, and you're just embarrassed because I was like, you know, I was like this amazing thing, like your special creation or something, and you don't like who I am now.
Yeah, who are you, Nick?
This is me, Dad, here. This is who I am.
Beautiful Boy. Tim?
Well, these films come in three types. The version where the family is, relatively speaking, poor or underclass. The version where the families are well-to-do, and the version where the family is middle class, and that's the version that this one is, right? They make for very different movies when you're watching these things. The version where the family is underclass and poor, they're very short movies because there's really nothing to be done. This is the kind of film where Steve Carell, who has a wife, a current wife, and two new kids, and an ex-wife out here in California, they feel like there's something to be done. and they marshal all of their resources and every cent they have, and they do rehab after rehab after rehab
for their son.
For their son, Timothée Chalamet, playing this boy who's this beautiful boy, like literally beautiful, brilliant, smart, gets into every college, and then one day, tries something that he shouldn't have tried. The film is very much about how sometimes this is simply a matter of brain chemistry. It has nothing to do with that human being. When these things get a hold of some people, it simply has them, and that's all there is to it. It doesn't make any difference what class you come from. I love the way this movie wanders around the pain and anguish of his parents. Every time they think they got him back, it'll break your heart.
Beautiful Boy is the film. It's at the Landmark in West L.A., the Arclight Hollywood. It's rated R. Steve Carell, Timothée Chalamet star, Felix Van Groeningen is the director and co-screenwriter. After Everything, a dramatic comedy written and directed by Hannah Marks and Joey Power. They both make their feature writing directing debut. Jeremy Allen White and Micah Monroe star. Amy?
Yeah, this is a young romantic comedy about a couple who, on their very first date, the boy just blurts out that he's been diagnosed with cancer because he hasn't been able to tell anyone else that this date with this girl might not go very well. He needs to tell somebody. He gets it out there. And what happens is this is about young love from two people who are very aimless. The boy has an app that he's never really going to code that will never, ever make him a millionaire. The girl is just an office worker at a company that she really isn't interested in. And them being young and in love and fighting cancer makes them both bloom. It's almost like an aphrodisiac. So it's this interesting romantic drama about how cancer brings them together, makes them feel special, makes them feel noble. And then what happens after that? It speeds up and slows down very fast. But I thought all the emotional beats in this film are really true. It's a really smart debut from two very, very, very young writer-directors. Hannah Marks is a young actress who people might have seen in a few things. Joey Power has been a very young director. And to see these two young filmmakers make a film with this much emotional intelligence really impressed me. And also Micah Monroe is an actress. She's been in a bunch of horror films. She was in It Follows. She was in The Guest. She's amazing. And so getting to see her in a dramatic role, I think, is really great.
Movies After Everything, written and directed by Hannah Marks and Joey Power. It's unrated at the Vintage Los Feliz. Moynihan, a biographical documentary of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a senator from New York, ambassador, and a highly influential intellectual in American life. Tim?
A highly influential intellectual who was born in Hell's Kitchen. To a single mother, abandoned by his father very, very young, grew up a brawler. Daniel Patrick Moynihan came into my life in the middle 70s or something when I was 13, 14 years old and deeply into politics. And he was the guy with the bow tie and the little glasses, and he spoke so eloquently. And I had always thought that he was like the Kennedys. From on high,
because that's the image he projected.
He projected it, but he developed that image, but no. He was from Hell's Kitchen. And the Daniel Patrick Moynihan that I knew was fairly venerated in the black community. But there had been a moment in the 60s when he wrote a report called The Negro Family, A Case for National Action. And that report was interpreted mostly by black radicals and liberals as an attack on black people. And here was this man who was dedicated, actually, to equality and civil rights and all of that. And he was being attacked from the left. And being attacked from the right. And he reared up on his hind legs and he fought back. It was just, this is a fascinating film. Goes back into the deep history of his life. I learned so much. And I got to tell you, you want to know what's going on in politics today? Watch this movie. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan will tell you what's going on. You hear his voice quite often, but he's never actually interviewed in a sit-down, on-camera interview in the film. We just hear his voice from various different sources. All kinds of wonderful footage, towering intellects from every community that you can think of across the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
And a man who was very respected and regarded within the Senate at the same time. And the other thing, the report that you mentioned that he led, you know, there were a lot of complex results, and I hope the film got into that because it was so sort of dumbed down with people that attacked him, as you say, from both the left and the right.
Yeah, and they did. The report, for one thing, was never meant to be made public. All right, it was leaked, so we're still doing that back then. And
goes back to the revolution.
and you're right, it's a very complicated report. Dr. Martin Luther King felt that report was very salient. but he never said it publicly. And he told Patrick Moynihan, I'll never be able to say this publicly.
Moynihan, the documentary, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. It's directed by Joseph Dorman and Toby Pearl Freelich. It's unrated. 22 July is a story of Norway's terrorist attack in which over 70 people were killed. Is it the 10-year anniversary of that attack? The film is from Norway, and it's written and directed by the tremendous talent Paul Greengrass. Amy, what did you think of the film?
Yeah, you know, Paul Greengrass does a bunch of Bourne films, but he also did United 93, the story of R-9/11.
So good.
So good. And that film was just very dry, very deadpan, very like real time. This is how it went. He's looking for something larger here in 22 July. For a minute, I thought this might be real time. It begins as though it is and then covers the end of the court case. It covers everything. This is the case, by the way, where a young man blew up a building in Oslo and then went to the island and ended up shooting a bunch of young children that he believed were the kids of the wealthy and therefore people who are going to ruin the planet. And it was up to him to sort of shock people into shutting down immigration. And what this film is I enjoy that it takes the shooter and it doesn't do the thing where you could at all look at him and think that he could be a hero. They make him extra pathetic, I felt like. They make him seem like someone you could never respect. Not quite a monster, but someone without any heroic underpinning, which I think is really good. Because I worry sometimes when you have films that give a lot of time to a real-life shooter like this, that he can inspire more because this shooter actually definitely wanted to. And what sort of happens after the attack? Greengrass takes care to not make it lurid at all with any of the shootings. Instead, he singles out one survivor. And they sort of build forward to this moment where they're both facing each other down in the courtroom with one young man representing where Norway could be going forward as like a progressive country that supports immigration. And then the one young man who wants to shut it down. I found this film a little long and a little dry. I found it intellectually really respectable. What did you think, Tim?
Greengrassian is what it is. I think that there is something that we can call a Paul Greengrass film, and certainly the beginning of this film, which almost has no dialogue in it at all. We follow this young man as he carries out his attack. So he just lays that out, not quickly, but methodically. And I do love that Paul Greengrass is a director that knows you do not need every character to literally say everything that they are thinking for the audience to catch on. He understands that. Now, after we get past that, and the guy is under arrest, and we get into this sort of look at what this has done to society, the legal system, to the politics of the country, what he's doing then is he's exploring how are we going to react to this. The movie isn't about that guy at all. The movie is about everybody else in Norway. Everybody in Norway except that one guy. And that's what I think is the most interesting, intriguing thing about this movie.
All right. And you've coined Greengrassian for Paul Greengrass, the director of the film. And it's not as long ago as I thought in my introduction, 7 years ago, that this horrible attack was carried out in Norway. 22 July is the biographical drama. It's at selected theaters, also streaming on Netflix. The movie's rated R. And the writer-director, Paul Greengrass, was a guest on The Frame with John Horn. You can hear that conversation by visiting our Film Week page at kpcc.org. Coming up, we'll hear what Tim and Amy think of Apostle, as well as The Sentence, and we'll talk with a rocket scientist we had on earlier this week on Air Talk. She's a big fan of the film about Neil Armstrong, First Man. We'll talk about favorite films that have space as a theme. Back in just a couple minutes. Coming up a little bit later on Film Week, we'll talk about favorite space films. Which ones are the most realistic? We brought a pro in to talk with us about the science that's on display in these movies. She was with us on Air Talk earlier in the week. She's an aerospace engineer and rocket scientist, Anita Sengupta, who was at JPL for nearly two decades and is an adjunct research associate professor of astronautics at USC, among other things. So she'll be joining us in a few minutes. But first, we have a few more films this week to talk about. Next is the horror thriller Apostle, written and directed by Gareth Evans. Amy?
Yeah, Gareth Evans is a big name to cult action fans for two movies, The Raid and The Raid 2. This is him showing he can do more things than having people beat each other up to death in Jakarta, which those movies are super fun.
Yeah.
Are you guys laughing because you like them? Or you...
I loved your introduction to the two big movies. Yeah.
Well, they are special. And this is him showing he can do something more in the key of like a period piece gothic thriller. This has Dan Stevens going to an island off the British Isles where there's sort of a proto-Jamestown thing happening in ye olden days. He's a heroin addict. He's trying to rescue his sister who's been held hostage. And this island, of course, has a dark Wicker Man sort of secret that gets revealed. But really what Gareth Evans is trying to reveal is just that he can also do bloody, horrible, gory, shocking, kind of delightful, but also overlong things in a movie with a totally different setting. This is kind of an advertisement for his
career. I'm a sucker for these sorts of small village religious cult human sacrifice films.
You've got
long as they're not too violent as contradictory as that sounds.
They're not going to work.
Yeah,
not going to work.
Human sacrifice, but low on the violence.
Not going to work for you. These movies can be interesting if they approach these things in a very sort of particular way, right? And this one seems to be. You're into this movie. Dan Stevens is quite good. And everybody's quite good. And Michael Sheen, as this cult leader, he gives these speeches standing there about the Lord and the fire and brimstone and all this stuff. And if it were just that, and this were simply about this heroin addict trying to save his sister from this crazy cult and fight his way off that island, I would really like this movie. But it's not. It's mystically and magically. And that's cheating. If you really
want
to
do... your rules adhered to in the film.
You really want to do this right, don't cheat.
Apostle, the horror thriller. It's streaming on Netflix. You can see it also on the big screen for a big thrilling experience. Lemley's NoHo Theater, North Hollywood. It's unrated, written and directed by Gareth Evans. The documentary The Sentence is directed by Rudy Valdez, making his feature documentary directorial debut. Tim?
A young woman named Cindy Shank in Michigan got involved with a boyfriend, you know, one of these kind of guys, and he was a nice guy, and she fell in love. Turned out that he was dealing drugs. When he gets busted, she, as the girlfriend who was not participating in the drug dealing at all but knew about it, gets sentenced to 15 years because of the way the sentencing structure
mandatory
works.
Minimums.
Mandatory minimums and all this stuff. But it's perfectly insane. She has a chance to plea bargain. She won't do it. She wants to fight back against this as just an idea. He was my boyfriend. I wasn't doing anything. You're just beating me up now. And frankly, this is only happening to women. The boyfriends of female drug dealers don't get it. It was only happening to women. This film is all about her experience as made by her brother, who is the director of the film. One thing that comes across wonderfully in this film, she has these two young daughters, is how wonderful a mother she is, locked up in prison, still mothering her daughters as best as she can on the phone and letters and cards, and how her entire family apparatus around her, her other brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles, are set up to make sure that those little girls understand that her mother is right there and she'll be back. And we go through a whole bunch of stuff, but it's just a really powerful film. These sentencing men, they're just insane. They're crazy, and they beat up the women. The boyfriend would have gotten out of prison before her. That's how crazy these laws are.
The Sentence is the film. It's an HBO documentary. You can see it on HBO next week. You can also see it right now at Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. Rudy Valdez, the director, and it's unrated. The Kindergarten Teacher stars Maggie Gyllenhaal and Parker Sivak with Gael Garcia Bernal. Sarah Colangelo is the writer, director. Tim?
Well, this is a very good movie. A bit of a controversy about it. A little bitty boy in kindergarten has this amazing ability to compose this poetry, sort of like a savant. His kindergarten teacher, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, is deeply impressed by this. Now, she's going through some issues of her own as she takes this writing class, and she comes to realize that she's not a very good poet, the class being taught by Gael Garcia Bernal. Now, yeah, she takes the kid's poetry and she starts passing it off as her own, but that's not what this movie is about. This movie isn't about that at all. This movie is about love and how love can become extremely misdirected. And that's what the controversy was about. There's this sort of proto-romantic thing going on between this grown woman and this five-year-old boy who writes this beautiful poetry that she is enthralled by. And she does something that's a little bit crazy.
the kindergarten teacher. It's streaming on Netflix. It's also at Landmark's Regent Theater in Westwood, rated R. And finally this week, the documentary Studio 54 about the club that burned so bright for a few years in the heart of New York City. Tim?
Went to Studio 54 in 1978.
Did you?
My daddy took me to Studio 54. My dad did a lot of inappropriate things with me, but, you know, we had a hell of a lot of fun. And Studio 54 was a fantastic place. This documentary is a lot of fun. All kinds of figures, you know, the Drew Barrymores and all that kind of stuff that hung around Studio 54, as well as the owners of the club. Look, it was a bright and shining star that was bound to burn out hot and fast, and it did. This is a lot of fun, a throwback to an era. I think you should check it out if you're, like, over 55.
I had the pleasure of hearing Nile Rodgers talk about the stories of Studio 54 in the heyday.
Yeah.
Wow. Studio 54, the documentary, is unrated. It's at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. So now we turn our attention to the science in films devoted to space and which ones you think are strongest. I'd love to have your feedback on it at 866-893-KPCC. If you're listening live to Friday's Film Week, you can also share it on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. With me is Anita Sengupta, formerly of Jet Propulsion Lab, NASA facility in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. She's a senior VP of Systems Engineering for Virgin Hyperloop One and also teaches at USC in the aeronautics program. Anita, thank you for joining us again. I appreciate it. You were sharing with me off air when you were in earlier this week that you thought the new film about, you know, that tells the story of the first moon landing and particularly the personal story of Neil Armstrong, first man, was just a great film. What made it work so well for you?
So to start off with, I'm a massive science fiction fan and space buff. And I think one of the reasons why people become science fiction fans is somebody said it, not me, but it inspires a sense of wonder, the exploration of the unknown and the technologies that take you to get to that place. And so what was so unique about this movie versus all the other space movies that I've seen before is that versus seeing like a two-dimensional scroller of different people talking back and forth, this was actually the story through the eyes of an individual. So you felt as though you were experiencing what Neil Armstrong was experiencing in like a first person type of way, as opposed to a third person type of way. And so there was the emotional aspect of that, of actually experiencing it through his eyes. And the quality of the special effects, I mean, it looked real. The quality of how they put together the different engineering scenarios that they did for the Gemini testing that he was originally a part of. And then, of course, the actual moon landing and everything going from launch to cruise to rendezvous and docking to landing on the surface. All of that was actually completely accurate from an engineering perspective. So I was just in awe of how it was the perfect package of a beautiful film, beautiful cinematography, accurate engineering, and finally a space movie where you're experiencing it as the individual.
Why do you think it's so difficult for these movies to get the engineering part right?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like, you know, there's no shortage of people in the Los Angeles area, as we talked about the last program, where they have an expertise in this. But it could be that maybe some people want the sort of whiz-bang action aspect movies, and so they focus on that and make it silly. And I think they almost always come off best when they're most accurate. And so you could go back several decades to 2001, A Space Odyssey, and 2010. Those are another examples of movies that I think did it more accurately and had far more of a profound impact.
Even though they're set so far in the future.
Exactly. And I think they still did a great way of representing the geopolitical conflicts, the way that we would interpret interacting with an alien species, I guess, in the context of 2001. And I think what this movie also did very well, because, I mean, I've seen La La Land, and it's the same director, I believe.
Yeah, Damien Chazelle.
Is they were able to combine the right times to play the right music and the right times to have silence.
All right. We'll continue our conversation, but I'd like to hear from you, your favorite films that are set in space, 866-893. KPCC back in a minute on Film Week. Which films set in space get it most right? That's what we're talking about on Film Week this week that saw the release of First Man, the story of Neil Armstrong. Ryan Gosling stars as the astronaut who first set foot on the moon. We're at 866-893-KPCC for those listening live. Amy Nicholson with us, Tim Cogshell as well. Amy, do you have a favorite that you just, I know you're not a scientist, but that feels really authentic?
Gosh, you know, I always think of a book, James Michener's Space. I know that we're on a movie program, but James Michener's Space is one of my all-time favorite books, and it's also the story of the initial rocket builders to landing a man on the moon and then what happened in science after that. James Michener gives a little speech in the book about how he's worried that since we did something so intimidating, I suppose, to humans, that we might enter a period of anti-science. Which he wrote that in 1981, and I think about that all the time. That book means so much to me.
As we live in the middle of this period of anti-science, the right stuff.
At the same time, science is progressing pretty dramatically.
Yeah, and quickly, despite the right stuff in terms of the Apollo.
I love the right stuff.
So meticulous. Of course, it's not just a movie. It's a big old series, and of course, the acting is just extraordinary. The Ed Harris, Sam Washington, everybody is in that movie. But I suppose if we go all the way back to the 50s, right? So I think that's when, there's 1929, the woman on the moon. But in the 50s is when I think we tried to start thinking about space travel in a quasi-realistic way. So you have movies like Rocket Ship XM, which is about a mission to the moon, which goes awry, and they end up on Mars, which is a little crazy. But
that's not accurate.
We missed it.
But the intention was correct. And they experienced things like asteroid storms and things like that. They were thinking about stuff like that. Conquest of the Moon, about 1955 or something like that, they have airlocks in that movie. They're really thinking about the way this would actually have to work. There ends up being aliens, but other than that, we're there. Then when we get to the 60s, it's when just the space travel itself becomes relevant, as you said, 2001 and films like that. In the 70s, it all becomes space opera, of course, Star Wars and all of the myriad knockoffs of Star Wars. And then I suppose in the 80s and 90s, we get back to quasi-serious space travel again, Red Planet. Mission to Mars, the De Palma film, things like that. There's still usually some sort of aspect of a horror film or something going on, but the technology, they're working really hard on getting the technology right by the time you get there.
There's one when I was a kid I remember that I like. Marooned was the movie about astronauts who get trapped, no way to return. 1969, so it would have been 10 years old for me. And it was released just after the Apollo 11 moon landing, won the Oscar for Best Visual Effects, and NASA provided authentic replicas of equipment and an early Skylab mock-up for that film, Marooned, from 1969. Ben in Culver City says, and not necessarily realistic, but his favorite space film is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which just has such a great performance by Ricardo Montalban. I think probably his best performance in a whole career of terrific performances, but that's such a great one. Let's talk with Teresa, who joins us from Van Nuys. Teresa, your favorite space film?
Larry, two words, Forbidden Planet.
Walter Pigeon. Yeah, Forbidden Planet.
1956, Fred Wilcox directed that movie. The technology, the state, for one thing, that was a studio film. That was not a B movie. That theremin and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it was very lush looking.
Yeah. Of course, it's just the Tempest. It's the Tempest, sort of reconstructed. It's just lovely. Really love Forbidden Planet.
Yeah. So, Teresa, that's still your favorite space film? All right.
That was it, Forbidden Planet.
All right. Thanks so much. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says, Apollo 13 is one of my two favorite movies. It satisfies the space program side of me, and I'm wondering if First Man might replace that. I also love 2001. I consider, Bill says, Star Wars, Star Trek more as popular sci-fi, so I put them in a little bit of a different category as opposed to movies like The Martian that would have more realism in it. Anita, what did you think of The Martian?
I thought it was a wonderful movie. The book, I highly recommend reading it if you haven't, because it goes into excruciating technical details. So you can actually make sure that everything makes sense. So I thought the movie was quite accurate. I think the technology challenges and the technology solutions that the lead character came up with were correct. I think the premise was a bit flawed, which was the absolute loss of the communication signal, because you always invariably have multiple antennas. So that was my one issue. And of course, we do have an orbiting. We have several satellites that orbit Mars, specifically the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So I'm pretty sure they would have been able to see that he was on the surface before that. Other than that, that minor nit, it was a wonderful and accurate engineering film.
So Interstellar, as I recall, there was some controversy about the sciences depicted in that film, despite it's a very, very popular movie. What did you think of it?
Well, I absolutely love Interstellar, and I'll tell you, one of my guilty pleasures of international plane travel is I always watch Interstellar on every flight that I
really?
Go on. I do absolutely love it. So Kip Thorne was part of that movie in terms of providing technical input. So I think a lot of it is just really thinking outside of the box. And I think part of what makes science fiction so wonderful, though, is that you can't always think about things in the context of how we do understand physics, how we do understand particle physics or quantum mechanics. So I think that movie tried to make us think outside of that box and perhaps went a bit too far. But at the same time, it was very entertaining and it was very beautifully done.
Yeah. Pippi writes Red Planet with Val Kilmer and Carrie Ann Moss.
Yeah.
That sounds like something you would have seen, Tim.
Oh, yeah. Red Planet is on my list. And again, working real hard on the science and the technology of that movie. And then they had to turn that robot into a monster because, you know, you got to have something else going on in the movie. But they're working real hard on that speculative science, the spacesuits and things like that, which I saw the new NASA design for spacesuits, and they look a lot like the spacesuits in Red Planet. Sort of, I would wear one of those, on Earth, but not on Mars. It was really slick.
Now, a movie I haven't seen from 1968 that apparently Robert Altman was directing called Countdown. Have you heard of this film?
I don't know Countdown.
So, yeah, I was seeing this Variety article that goes back a few years ago. But apparently it was a Cold War thriller about two American astronauts trying to beat the Soviets to the moon. But Altman was fired by Warner Brothers, according to Variety, because he wouldn't reshoot. He had the overlapping dialogue thing, and they didn't want that. And he refused to reshoot it, so he was fired by the film. But apparently NASA granted Altman tremendous access for doing that film. So that's 50 years ago this year, that film. All right. Amy, any others you want to add to your list?
Oh, I'm just intrigued that nobody's called in to say anything about the Ridley Scott Prometheuses, which I'm fine with. I'm fine with them. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to Tim's point. Like, why do we always need to throw a monster into a space movie? Why can't space just be awesome enough? And to me, that is frustrating. Mm. I think space on its own should be great. I wish Ridley Scott made alien movies where there wasn't always some poisonous plant that then would take people over. I think just being stranded is enough.
All right.
I agree.
Anita, you should make your own film now. So you're such a film buff. You should go out and direct. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Anita Sengupta with us, rocket scientist, aerospace engineer. She was with JPL for nearly 20 years, teaches astronautics at USC, and is senior VP at Virgin Hyperloop 1. For our Film Week critics, Amy and Tim, I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to come join us in person. Our next Film Week screening series at the Theater at Ace Hotel, Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, 1 o'clock. We'll show the Oscar-winning film The Artist. What better place than a beautiful historic theater to see a film that pays tribute to the movie industry here in L.A. as it moved from silent to talkies from the 20s to 30s. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person from all of us. Have a great weekend.